That'll work.
Now, do we want to, I think they're gonna, for the video, they'll probably want us to stand, or let the city want doesn't need to.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, because of the camera, don't we have, this is really hot.
So. Yeah, we can take turns going up there too. Yep. There we go.
Well, you got it there.
We know, though.
But it's after, so we'll be doing the questions.
Yeah. We do like 5 or 7 minutes each. Okay.
So maybe me, and then we'll go to Cecilia. And do we want after Cecilia go, or do we have time for? I think Dawn's got it on her sheet.
The order?
Yeah. Oh. That's okay. I was thinking every time we kind of respond.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon now. As you're willing and able, would you please rise and sing with me? We're going to sing a song, and this is not only a stall tactic for some of the stuff happening in larger groups, giving people time to find us way out here in Eastern Washington, but also an opportunity to just share in the spirit and share in the community being together. There is more love somewhere.
Now we've got a people out there. You're going to find where that more love is may be in surprising, wonderful, unknown to many of us at the time places that we're going to be talking about. Welcome to finding this this space. You'll hear also a term mentioned off and on during our time together. Comes from the new monastic movement. It's called the Abandoned Places of Empire. And I feel like we are gathering in the abandoned place of the center out here that we have today. But welcome to Love the Hell Out of the World part one, Basics of Missional Church, or Missional Church 101, or however it was referred to. First of all, just a mention about the Red Pill Brethren and the sponsoring of this, of our workshops today. Because we get asked sometimes about that, and the Red Pill Brethren is, it's kind of like an online, I've come to think of it, it's kind of like an online study group and support group for some who are going deeper into the missional church movement within Unitarian Universalism and without. We have both mostly Unitarian Universalists right now, but not limited to Unitarian Universalists, and not limited to clergy as well. As you'll in our next workshop, you'll experience some of that as well. Even though we're all clergy that are on the panel today, not all in our study and support group are clergy by intention. So this is the first of two-part workshops that we're doing today. This is going to be the general theoretical, inspirational, vision casting, what's it all about workshop. And then we're going to follow that with one where we get to go into a little more detail about our learning curves, details, how's it being lived out in some communities and relationships and some of the visions that's trying to be planted around the country particularly. So I encourage you, our next workshop right after this, there's about a 30-minute frame, and that'll be in B is in something, 115, 116, to do that. We were going to begin with a two-minute video, but I had projector problems, but we wanted to, and I think on your handout might even be, I'm not sure if it's listed under the resources, but it's a two-minute video. It's the first thing that comes up when you Google Missional Church video. So if you just Google Missional Church video, there's a two-minute simple kind of explanation. If you've got somehow the Wi-Fi blessing you, you could even pull it up, but we encourage you to do that. It really kind of talks about a fundamental kind of shift between church as attracting people to come to be with us and be like us, to going out to where people are and being church out and among them. But I encourage you to find that video and share it. It's a good way to do that. I might say in my introductions, and we still have people coming in, that video, like a lot of things that you'll find about the missional church movement in the United States anyway, comes out of a fairly progressive but still a Christian orientation and experiences and some of the language. But we found it very helpful in many different settings. And the missional church itself, even though in its really explosion in the last 25 years in the United States, the roots and the applications and really the fundamental kind of principles behind it have been tapped into by many different traditions, and I think you'll get that, I hope, today as well, how even though it may come from a particular specific tradition, and we're thankful for that, but it's also one that can be applied in many different ways. And even among those of us that are here and that will be presenting some of the information on our panel, we have a diversity of theological orientations and ways that missionalism is being incorporated into our communities kind of across the spectrum. Cecilia Kingman, here in a minute, will begin our presentations. Cecilia is in Seattle, a minister at Edmonds? At Edmonds?
There they are.
There they are. Yay! Woo! All right. Came the shortest distance to be with us, as we say here today. And she'll be given a kind of a theology and I would say some of the broad brush strokes, touching on some of the things that you have in your handout, although that handout actually, I'll take blame and credit or whatever for it, so she doesn't have to. But that's kind of the theoretical, the theology, the broad brushstrokes of things. And then Jake Morrell from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, will be bringing it home in a way, talking about different applications and ways that the series and the ideas are being expressed and lived out in the world. And then we're going to have a time for questions. That's why you have note cards, and we'll have people collecting your questions. We're actually going to kind of do that kind of in the middle to two-thirds of the way through our time together so that we have a chance to respond kind of quickly. And then Don Cooley from Louisville, Kentucky, will be, will be preaching us home. Preaching it to take home, the take home message with you, and it's inspirational. I'm Reverend Ron Robinson from the Welcome Table Missional Community in Oklahoma. I think we asked each other to begin our talks with a story about what brought us to this particular. To be here today with you, talking about what we're going to be talking with you today. And so each of the presentations will begin with a personal story. And this is, in my case, this is my time to quit talking except for responding to questions. So I get to end it with the personal story. I am here and with this topic really because I failed as a church planner in many ways. I failed at what I thought what I wanted to try to create a church as, and in doing so, I discovered what the world needed from me and from our church community, and so we transformed. And I'll be talking about that a lot more at the second workshop. But I had started a church, or I say a kind of a tractional church back in the early 90s, and thought that trying to do so again in the early 2000s I knew everything that I needed to know, and tried to start in a big suburban area. And when that didn't really, I wasn't able to create an attractional, church in that environment, and restarted in an urban, poorer area. It was the beginning of my rethinking about what church means and what it can be. And I was we still, even in the urban, poorer section of Tulsa where I live, we were still kind of primarily worship focused in our initial outreach to the community, and still trying to attract people to come in to us, until a workshop that I had with a wonderful Southern Baptist missional leader who goes and talks to anybody, and named Reggie McNeil. And through that workshop, I began to have this vision of a building that was right across from where our church was located, an abandoned building. And I began to have this vision of what it would mean for the community if we opened up that building, not as a church, but as a community center, and then just worshiped within it and other places. And once I had that kind of epiphany moment, we began kind of the transformation of our community from church into community center, where the church went more organic. And so that was really my red pill kind of moment, was having that kind of vision during his workshop. And then as we had talked with people in our community, and as I say, we'd found out that and asking them what they really needed in their lives, I was not hearing about sermons. I was not hearing about our religious education programs. I was hearing about food and health and getting rid of stray dogs and jobs and safety and all these kinds of issues. Life expectancy in our poor area is very low. So that really fundamentally was kind of part of the shift in our community from being into what we call kind of making an inside-out transformation that came. And ever since then, I've been learning from many people about what church might be able to be envisioned in a broad sort of way, many, many different manifestations in our world today. So that's my story, and I'm now going to turn it over to Cecilia to give us her story and more.
Good afternoon. So as Ron said, this workshop is brought to you by the Red Pill Brethren. I imagine that name can be a little confusing sometimes. And so I'm wondering if you, most of you have probably seen The Matrix, right? And do you remember that part where the choice is offered, where, or if you haven't seen the movie, the choice is offered to take the red pill or the blue pill. And the blue pill lets you stay in that falsely constructed reality the characters are living in, the comfortable one where you don't really know what is underneath and behind things. And the red pill has a different effect. When you take the red pill, everything you knew drops away, and you see through the facades and the illusions and are aware of the reality of things, the deepest things, and of what you need to do. So the Red Pill Brethren are a group of missionally minded folks who mostly you use, as Ron said, who have had a red pill moment, and everything we knew about church and religious life shifted to a new understanding. So I think we actually have continual red pill moments, at least that's my experience, but I did have one, as Jake just referred to it, road to Damascus red pill experience when I was quite young, and it's quite personal to me, and taking a page from the instructions that Marlon Lavenhar gave us last night, I'm going to tell you something that I'm a little scared to tell the people in my religious community. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm about to lose my voice too, so just do this if you... So, with apologies to my folks from my congregation who have never heard this story before, and if you hear a big gasp go up now, you'll know why. I'm going to tell you quite a personal story about my red pill moment. When I was a teenager, one of my parents was arrested and was sent to prison, and our family began a relationship with that principality and power known as the criminal justice system. I went from a middle-class life off to college. This happened in my first year of college, to having to drop out of college to care for my younger siblings. And then my family and I struggled for several years, or really for numerous years, financially and emotionally. And some members of my family have never recovered from that blow. And I won't ask you to raise your hands, but I know that there are some of you in this room who have interacted in one way or another with that criminal justice system, and you know of what I speak. The church of my childhood, and I won't name the denomination, but the church of my childhood failed me in that hour of need. More importantly, though, for our topic today, my life and well-being became bound up with those others, the lives of others who also were interacting with the prison industrial complex. Not only the people in the prison and their families, but even the people who worked in the prison. And that, for me, everything dropped away from that. And my eyes were opened to the suffering in our world, to the lives of those most cast aside by our society, people who are imprisoned and their families. And I knew that the church must be able to not just help people, not even just minister to people who are cast aside. The church must actually live in those abandoned places. I was fortunate enough in my 20s to enter Unitarian Universalism through the doorway of a church that endeavors to do that, First Unitarian here in Portland. That church saved my life. When people say Unitarian Universalism saves lives, it saved mine. Thank you. But I have to say, in my travels through Unitarian Universalism since then, I'm not sure that would have happened in a great majority of our churches. And it certainly isn't happening in a great majority of the mainline churches overall. That's my story. And I hope that, in the spirit of the invitation Marlon gave us last night, you will tell some of those stories to one another as you go home as well. Since this is a missional 101 workshop, it's my task to share some basic frameworks with you. I am the baby Red Pill Brethren member of this long-standing group, so I ask for that most simple tasks. A couple basic frameworks. First, Ron used the term attractional. So there is missional and there is attractional. And attractional is the bringing people to us. This is the normal model that we know of church life. We got some good stuff here and let's bring them to us. And missional is another thing. Missional is being sent out to serve. Not necessarily the same as a church mission or a mission statement. So when we're talking about missional, we're not talking about your mission statement, although your mission statement could be missional. the opposite of the old style missionary church, which went to others to convert them to become the church that already is. You understand? Which went with others to convert them. The missional church goes to be with others and to be converted ourselves, especially in our focus and in our forms, by them and their needs, in order to serve. The mission field, as opposed to the place where you go find all your converts, the mission field is the place where the church becomes itself missionally, where it is sent and lives out its covenant with the world beyond it. It is the answer to the question, who does the church exist for? Who does the church exist for? Why does it exist? And in particular, for whom does one's heart break? Or if you like this language, for whom does God's heart break? It can be very narrow and specific, such as one apartment complex or school or zip code or group of people struggling with a specific situation. Ron comes into that, or told you that story of his own missional community. It can also be connected with others and with a church or even a group of churches. It can be various sizes, although usually core groups are no more than 12 to 20. Other names that you will find if you search for this on the internet or in books are the incarnational church, the externally focused church, and the new monastic, the new monasticism. So it is sometimes seen as a category of the emergent or emerging church. You may have heard that language lately. But emergent is mostly seen as a postmodern worship reformation movement, great thing, with missional overtones and connections. But missional in focus includes worship sometimes, but doesn't have to. And worship may be with various other groups, may go somewhere else to receive worship and then come back together to be the missional church. Now, this is a culture shift that occurs from where church was primary and mission field was secondary and was a resource for the church. And by resource, I mean quite specifically new members and pledges. That's usually how we are thinking of it, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. I have done that work, so I'm not faulting it. But we shift to the unchurched or the de-churched culture, where church in our world now has been marginalized and the mission field is primary. And so church must now flow toward the mission field rather than expecting the mission field to flow toward it. Does that make sense? We're going to go out this way instead of trying to bring people to us. In the old culture, the church found its mission in how it differentiated itself from other churches. We're not like that church down the street. We don't do that, or we believe this instead of that. Or, you know, some of those points in the mainline denominations are quite fine, aren't they? But that's what we did. We distinguished ourselves from the churches that were around us. That puts the focus on the church institutionally, and making more members is then the mission, you see? Especially if it was a church like we are, where most of its members came from other churches. So the identifier is, this is who we are, we're not like that other thing. And if you want to be like us and believe like us, then you are here, okay? But the external focus in the emerging culture, where mission field is primary, the external community put less focus on churches and the churches increased their focus on themselves. So that's part of the causality of us turning inward. If this is news to you that Unitarian Universalism has spent some time focusing inward, I can recommend a couple other workshops. So the mission used to be to perpetuate churches in a world where we wanted people to come in. A world where the church as an institution has been marginalized now and the mission field has become primary. So too should the church shift from focusing on building itself up to building itself in engagement with our neighbors and building up the world around us, its missional field. Now, I want to speak theologically for a moment, as if anything we ever said wasn't theological. I want to speak theologically for just a moment. This is a crucial point, and I love this. I'd like our next t-shirts to say this. The church doesn't have a mission. The mission has a church. okay? Or churches, if we don't want to be the church universal. The church does not have a mission. The mission has a church, okay? Theologically speaking, the mission of the church, or what we like to call it in fancy seminary words is ecclesiology, is a salvific healing response to the suffering and the ways that we have been separated from the image of God and from the aims of that Imago Dei. I'm actually quoting Ron Robinson right now, by the way, from that Imago Dei being manifest in beloved community. So the image of God being manifest, as we would say in our church, heaven made manifest on earth, okay? Like bring heaven on earth, all right? So we are to be oriented towards those who are suffering. And suffering comes in many forms. Discovering the suffering that you are called to address and create church to respond to, that's where your heart is breaking. But it's important for us to keep in mind that not all suffering is of a same scale, and not all suffering has the same resources to bring to bear to ease that suffering. There is spiritual suffering, which I think a great many middle and upper class people in the United States experience. There's the suffering of isolation and abandonment and addiction and all of those things. And then there is material suffering. There is not having sufficient food, period. And there is plenty of that in and around our world. We have that in our congregation as middle class as we and upper middle class as we seem. We have families that are food insecure, and they are hiding it all the time in our church. So the church must not be content, again, Ron Robinson, the church must not be content to be a safe home until all homes are safe. Okay? We cannot isolate ourselves out of the context in which we are. And so the church cannot grow and thrive if the people in and around our community are not also growing and thriving. We have failed. We have failed to be the church if we have looked away from that. So there are four paths, or the loop of churching. There's missional service. There's community life, be together in order to better serve. There is structures of leadership and training and teaching and bringing along in order to help other people better serve. And then there is worship in some form or another, some place, that refreshes the soul and deepens the community life. And so in this framework, worship is not the primary thing we do. It is the thing we do to nurture ourselves and restore ourselves and everyone else so that we can do more in the world. Do you see that shift? It's a big shift. It's not Sunday morning is not what church is about. Sunday morning or Sunday evening or Wednesday evening or whenever you have worship life. The worship life is what sustains us in the mission. Okay? Missional church is grounded in the three R's of relational community development. These are the three R's, and I actually have a fourth that I'll tell you too, or 3B, as I like to call it with Ron. It is known by how it relocates into abandoned places. You relocate. Now, that may not mean physically moving your church someplace else, although that does happen, and churches of ours have chosen to do that. Relocating orientation into the abandoned places in this empire in which we live. There's reconciling, helping to restore what is hurting and lost and suffering. And then there is redistributing. So we have relocating, reconciling, and redistribution. And I understand this to mean redistribution of resources and attention, wealth, time, redistribution. And then I like to call the fourth R resilience, because I think we live in a time where we have to attend to the task of resilience for ourselves and for everyone else, for what is coming with climate change and social change and all of that. What does it mean to be resilient communities? But that one I stuck into the three R's. So these are the most vulnerable places and people with the least resources, these abandoned places, that seek reconciliation interculturally, learning from others, not always leading but being led by others, and practices this redistribution of goods and restoring the commonwealth. There are a lot of ways to live this out, and in the understanding of the three R's or the four R's, you can do this institutionally, but we are inviting our people to do this in their own lives as well. So teaching and modeling and being examples in that. So one last point, and I love this, and again, I'm just gonna quote Ron, because why would I write it myself if I could quote Papa Bear? The missional church is a redundancy. To say the missional church is a redundancy. To live missionally, we become a part of the church, the movement in the world for liberation and radical love that may take many names and forms. Church is a response to the call to love all creatures and all people, to grow the world into a more just and kind and loving place, a more merciful place, and as our shirts say, to love the hell out of this world. So we're going to do a little panel discussion here and let these guys respond. If you have questions, though, would you please write them down, and we're going to pick them up and answer a few questions, too. Okay, Cal?
Well, I'll share some of my story because I think that it provides a little counterpoint to the notion of the road to Damascus moment, the moment of conversion. For me, it was a process of gradual erosion in my ministry, of sort of the wheels falling off between 2009, 2011, and realizing that I wasn't, you know, I was, there was a conversation with the board talking about the budget, and somebody on the board said, well, we have to do the have-tos first, and then we can do the want-tos. The want-tos were very small. And, you know, I was struck by that, thinking, wow, we are in this self-governing congregation. This is the board, and I am the minister, and we are stuck with the have-tos first, with the want-tos like this. So it was a gradual process. I realized that I had spent the first 5-6 years of my ministry trying to grow the church, trying to push the church to strengthen its membership, strengthen its fundraising, you know, do all those things that are based in ego, based in pride, and that are the opposite of why people join churches. You know, there's this sort of resigned chuckle that goes through the room when people talk about going on to committees. Because that chuckle is about how we've given up our dream, the dream that brought us to the doors of the church on that first day, the dream that said, I'm so scared walking into this community, but it's worth it because I imagine that life could be greater, that I could be part of some larger story, that I could be loved and loved and transformed, and that I could be part of some power that transforms the community. And then we end up on committee. Do a resigned chuckle, would you? And yet, oh, how sad, my people. There's this joke that goes, what do Unitarian Universalists see sign that says, this way to heaven, this way to discussion to heaven, you know, and the joke, and again, resigned chuckle, ha, 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 is what we want to go to the resign. So we want to go to the discussion about heaven. Red Pill Brethren, missional thinking says, no, neither one. We want to go to hell. We want to go to hell because that's where there's suffering. We want to go to hell because we want to empty it out with the power of love. Because that is the mission, not to have a discussion, not to gain salvation for our own beautiful selves, but instead to go to those places of suffering, those places of abandonment that have been forgotten, neglected, violated, and to be bearers of the light, those who have been wounded ourselves, bringing our own experience of hell and our own experience of love and transformation in heaven. There's this story that on Holy Saturday, between the crucifixion and the resurrection, called the harrowing of hell, where Jesus, so they say, it's not in Scripture, but they say, and there's plenty of paintings that will show this picture, is in hell. And there, and the paintings, these beautiful Renaissance paintings, have Jesus touching people on their hands and their arms. So that is the missional image, is going to places of suffering. I want to tell you that even though in 2011 I had this experience of finding the Red Pill Brethren, of finding language for why I first showed up for faith in the first place, that was not about the have-tos. It was about, you know, what filled my heart, what called me. Even though I had that moment, for me, I have to be reminded and reminded and reminded again. So a community of accountability, a community of people who are braver than me, who have gotten over themselves more than I have, who have less ego that keeps interrupting the process than I have, that is important to me. It reminds me of where I need to be and what I need to be about and why. So I was going to talk about application, but are we going to do discussion first? Are there questions?
Hi, I'm Dawn Cooley. I'm the minister of First Unitarian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, where I've been for 6 years. I'll share my red pill moment in just a moment. But what I wanted to say is you hear a lot, I hear a lot, in missional language, the theistic language. And so I want to share that I'm coming at this from a humanist perspective, from a mystic humanist perspective, not from a theist perspective. And so I wanted to just take a moment. So most of us cringe, right, when we hear about the theists or the Christians asking atheists how they can be moral without a belief in God, right? We go, ah, that question? Missional is the same way. You don't have to be a theist to be a missionalist. You can be absolutely a humanist, a Buddhist, whatever your theology is. For me, I feel that I am called by love, to be the hands of the ultimate in the world. Love tells me that we're all part of the same family and each of us is worthy of love. I feel like I am called by reason to be the hands of the ultimate in the world. My reason tells me that it is true, it is logical, that no one can be truly free while others are oppressed. I am called, I feel like, by my biology to be the hands of the ultimate in the world. My very DNA, the generations of ancestors who lived and died so that I could be here right now with you today, were helped along their way by others. Their lives were entwined with the lives of others to build and work towards, in, I believe, the beloved community. So in these ways and more, as a humanist, I feel called to put my hands on the moral arc of the universe and bend it towards justice. And so that's, for me, where missionalism fits in, that bending of the moral arc towards justice.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. And while they're coming up, I would say my sort of nuance to even some of my own words that Cecilia was presenting would be to kind of reiterate that there's a, what we use the term, a bigger bandwidth, that the missional church is not just one expression of what church can be. It can be very organic on one end, like mine is, without a board, bylaws, budgets, building, organizational structure, things like that. Or it can be very institutional. So if we're kind of down on the other end of the table with Dawn and at First Unitarian in Louisville. So there's a bigger bandwidth it all along the way that people can begin to make and begin to reorient their expression of their church into a more external a manner. And there's all kinds of ways and techniques and things like that to do that. The other thing is that we often talk about the difference between, because when people are talking about the missional church, often they are thinking in their minds about a church. Church as an organization, a 501c3 religious or you know, organization. And that is one part of the spectrum. But we also, really deeper into the missional church, we're talking about the church, and that there are different manifestations of the church or the movement that are being reflected. So that really, when if you have two or three people who kind of covenant together to go into that prison and to walk with people and to reflect on it with themselves and to grow and to be they are a manifestation of the church, and they are as important as if you have an organization or a church somewhere that is reorganizing itself into being a force in the community primarily. So those are a couple of things I want to kind of nuance. So just to be, they're always kind of challenging us in our thinking and our default modes. And when we hear the word church, if I look out onto the audience, many of you are like me, turning 61 today, and in that age, and I just grew up in that kind of church model where church, I had a church that was at a location, a building. I see a pulpit, I see a minister, I see programs, I see all these, an organization. And what I have learned is that church is very different. Church is, as Cecilia said, is the response. You know, one of the is a way that we respond and toward suffering. And so I hope I have talked a little bit enough for them to get their questions organized to begin dealing with some of them.
Take it away. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. There you go. You're first.
So some of these questions have to do, I'll stand up. I feel pressure. Everybody else stood up. Some of these questions have to do with how do we do this in congregations? And I'll briefly tell my sort of red pill moment, because I think that addresses many of these questions. Let's see, some of the questions, do the members do the work? What are the first steps a congregation takes? How do you do the institutional change? And what does it look like in a brick-and-mortar congregation? My missional red pill moment came in about 2010 or 2011. I was called to serve First Unitarian in Louisville in 2009, so right at the beginning of the economic collapse, right? It was a great time. It was my first full-time settlement. I was relatively new outside of seminary, and I had all these ideas and thoughts about how I thought church worked. Plus, I had all my experience going to church and being a leader in church, and so I really thought I knew how church worked. And it didn't. It didn't. We are an urban church. We're downtown. We're in the 13th poorest zip code in the urban zip code in the country, where there are no Unitarian Universalist churches in the top 12 urban zip codes. And so what we were finding is that the entire way we did church was no longer effective. That the white middle class, highly educated people were not necessarily coming at the same rate. The people weren't seeking. Sean Dennison touched on this beautifully in his Berry Street lecture the other day. The people weren't seeking information. They can get that in Wikipedia. They were seeking nurturance. They were seeking authenticity. They were seeking a place where they could struggle with the questions of life. And the congregations weren't necessarily, not just mine, but many of our congregations weren't prepared for that sort of vast shift. And we started having some struggles. We had financial struggles. We had struggles with the homeless coming in because we're downtown and sleeping on our porch because that's where they could stay out of the rain. And so suddenly we were asking these really, really big questions. Why are we here? The church burned in 1985, and they chose to rebuild in the same spot. Now, those of you who can remember and have institutional memory, in the 1980s, white flight from urban areas, and the church chose to stay. And so I started asking them, why did you stay? Why are you still here? Why are we in this spot? Why are we in this building? Why are we in this neighborhood? Why are we in this community? Why do we exist? And so we started a dialogue around that. And every sermon that I gave, I would ask, why are we here? Where are we going? And how do we get there? Why are we here? Where are we going? And how do we get there? I think in a lot of ways, our congregation looks like many congregations still, and I've got some folks here who can attest to that. And at the same time, I have seen the ground become verdant. All of the sharing of why are we here, why do we exist, how can we be involved in our community has led us to make some enormous changes in how we do things. One of the most recent examples is our Black Lives Matter vigils that we're having. So after worship on Sunday, we're going outside into the community, and we're standing there on the street corner, and we're meeting people, and we're waving at people who drive by, and we're holding signs, and we're having conversations with the people of color who live in the neighborhood or who are crossing through. This is the kind of interaction with the community that the church didn't necessarily have before. So it's not necessarily a once you have a red pill moment that you're going to immediately, you know just what to do. It's the beginning of a journey towards, well, what works for where I am, what works for this neighborhood, what works for this congregation, who are the people in our community, how can we help them, how can we be involved in their lives, and it's something that happens step by step, but constantly ask the question, why am I here, why are we here, who does our heart break for, why are we here, who does our heart break for?
So you heard Don talking about why, and I'm going to talk about application of mission. You know, what is that, of the missional model? How does it look? How do you do it? And I'm going to first tell you that that there is no how, and then I'm going to say how. Got it? Okay. So first, there's this line in missional thinking that the answer to how is yes. Okay? So the model... You know, people are always telling me that. I know you're surprised. Okay, so you're welcome. The answer to how is yes. And by that, it means that we can spend so much time focused on methodologies, on building consensus about strategy, on crafting mission statements, strategic plans, building consensus, so that everybody agrees and everyone's comfortable, that the air goes out of it, that we are not responsive, adaptive, nimble, and part of our ecosystem as the opportunities arise. So the answer to how is yes. The fundamental questions to keep asking over and over again is why. It's not what you do, but how you use what you do. I learned that from an evangelical friend of mine, and what he said is, so that line is, it's not what you do, it's how you use what you do. His answer was, for the glory of God, right? Like, you can serve breakfast, you can have a meditation group, you can do all kinds of things. It's not what you do, it's how you use what you do. He has a particular faith practice that's asking certain outcomes in people's lives. I think we have the same, that we are promoting changed lives, lives of passion and purpose, of transformation, lives that are transformed to go out and love the hell out of the world. But again, be cautious about having a mental model of how it looks. Keep coming back to why. Keep coming back to qualities of the Spirit. This also speaks to one of the functions of a leader, not necessarily the minister, but all leaders in a missionally oriented organization, is to talk a lot about why, to tell stories about why, to tell stories about impact, to tell stories about opportunities and needs in the community, to keep that question of why, as you heard that Don is doing in Louisville, to keep that question of why out before people, so that the question of how is always in light and in service of why. There is this idea that missional communities are like scrappy hipsters that don't have a budget. And those of us in sort of boring churches with membership committees can't do missional because we're not cool enough. So I'm from a nerdy church where we're all just nerds, and we have a building and we have a budget and we have staff and all that kind of stuff. And I would imagine a lot of you are in that position too. Somebody here asked about strategic planning, said they're on strategic planning, and how do you, you know, how do you lead toward naming these as priorities? I would say, this is very sneaky, so I'm telling you, but don't tell anyone else, because we're starting up a little spy cabal here. Don't start with the planning, with the power structures, with that kind of whole church thing. Just the Buckminster Fuller says, rather than reforming the current thing, build something alongside it. Build the new alongside it. Find where there's energy. Find where there's passion. Find a team of 5 to 7 people and go start feeding the hungry, spiritually or literally. You know, we just this past January had a consultant in and did goals and that. After 5 years of doing missional stuff, by that time there was enough buy-in, enough shift in the culture that it was a natural outcome of what we're doing to name as our goals and our mission and vision a missional culture. But had we done that 5 years ago, what we intend to do is yet da 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 da. Old habit would have ruled the day. So I say, don't start with center. Don't start with top down. It is a shift. Somebody asked about funding here. A couple people asked about funding. One thing about resources is it's important that a lot of times ministers are scapegoated. So what I mean by that is the minister does ministry on behalf of the congregation. Oh, Reverend so-and-so was at that rally. Oh, Reverend so-and-so knows that community leader. Oh, you know, like sort of borrowed virtue. Because the leader's role is to equip and to tell the stories and to hold the vision and to ask why, the going out and doing is the ministry of the people. And that's also a resource move, because if you're hiring out, if you're outsourcing all your work, oh, we need a coordinator for this, a coordinator for that, you're going to go broke in 6 months. And you'll miss the opportunity of transformation that the process of figuring out how to be in radical relationship with folks can bring. We have a stone soup ministry, a meals program. And one of the wonderful things that I love is not tracking that we're doing 100 meals in a serving. It's that I'm not sure who's a member of the church and who's a diner, because members of the church have started coming to eat because they are lonely. And members, folks who from the community who were coming to eat started like getting in the kitchen. When the served are in the kitchen and the servers are being served, when there's that relationship shift, that's when missional stuff is happening. That's when that kind of relationship, that shift is happening. Missional ministry is highly relational. So somebody here talked about social justice work. And I will say, this is a critique I have of the missional approach. So listen to this. We are often so focused as Unitarian Universalists on the rally, the protest, the statement, the assertion of identity. We are the people who do this, say this, act like this. So I live in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is home to a nuclear weapons plant. We have lots of powerful, sketchy stuff there. There are people who show up twice a year to protest the nuclear weapons plant. God bless them. There are people who show up at certain places where people have done bad stuff to protest, to bear witness, to say, boo, bad stuff, you're doing bad stuff. There is a place for that. And in the missional model, often the gesture will be, hello, brother, sister, sibling. Let me hear your story. You who've done bad things, you who are in hell, let me come alongside you. Let me walk with you a ways. Let me roll with you a ways, so that we can share our hearts. You have sinned, I'm going to use that word, and I have too. We are caught not only in this inescapable network of mutuality that leads to love and transformation, but this inescapable network of mutuality that has us drenched, doused in suffering and forgetfulness of our human nature. So it does not have that, it doesn't have everybody come to the rally and say boo to the other side, because when the diners are going into the kitchen and the church members are out being served, there is no other side. When we're being universalists, there's evil, and it's within some of our choices and lifestyles. It's within some of theirs, and we're just loving the hell out of them. Let me just, okay. I'm trying to see what these,
I want to just see one response quick to Jake.
So, Jake, I really appreciate you saying that. I'm mindful of the path that Gandhi walked, and that Oscar Romero, the martyred Archbishop of El Salvador, walked, which was always to remember that the people who are participating in systems of injustice are themselves also being victimized by their own injustice, by the system of injustice, and that Oscar Romero called out in his radio broadcasts to the people, to the military, the violent military dictatorship, brothers and sisters, those are his words, brothers and sisters, siblings, we are with you and we are praying for you, and please, please let us love you and come over to this side, come over to this path of love. So I just want to add that to Jake's comment.
There was also a question about how big are our church sizes? And so I just wanted to share that mine's just under 200 members. So that you, how large are the congregations that we serve so that people can get an idea of what this might look like? So mine's just under 200 members.
Oak Ridge is 260 members. Something we sort of stopped doing. We don't have a membership committee, so that's part of the missional shift, is some atrophy in the institution keeping stuff. I will say, somebody asked about fundraising. Our fundraising is better than ever because we're doing work that makes a difference.
So I serve a congregation. I'm the part of a shared ministry team in a congregation of 300, and I'm not going to put my congregation on the spot, but I would say that I don't come out of a congregation that is oriented missionally yet. So my boss isn't here, so I'll say that. We want to call for a few more questions. If you have more questions, will you hold them out and let our volunteers bring them forward?
And we don't do members at the welcome table, but I always, when I get that question, I always say my membership is 12,500, because that's the number of people that we serve in our 2-mile radius. We have we don't try to serve all of the Tulsa. We have a very self-defined 2-mile radius that we connect with and that we try to serve with, and our worshiping community is about 3 to 12 people. When we worship together, and then we connect with about 1,000 people a month through our missional manifestations.
Yeah, so we're going to do a couple more questions. I've got one here that I want to take right now, and while these guys look at theirs, someone asked, "Do wealthy people and groups move toward a missional path as often as those with fewer resources? Do you need to have lost or suffered to choose this path?" And I want to take a two-part answer. It is true that this kind of orientation towards the community comes more easily, I don't want to say more naturally, but more easily to communities where there are not as many wealthy people. Because wealth allows us to practice the illusion of our own separateness. It allows us to insulate ourselves and pretend we're not suffering. And so the African American church, they don't have really a missional movement, because this is the African American, historic African American church. Working class Catholic churches, this is the model. Working class Pentecostal, this is how it is. This is the church. So it may seem harder because we who are more comfortable can sustain ourselves on our illusion of separateness and self-sufficiency for quite a long time. The end of my story is that I'm now quite a financially secure person. I'm fortunate enough to be a kept woman in a certain way. Every minister really needs a spouse that can care for them. And what I have noticed is that temptation towards the separateness and the self-sufficiency. And it is an addiction, people, to think that we do not depend upon other people in our, you know, in all ways. So my missionalism lives itself in the neighborhood that my partner and I and our children live in, which is right on the intersection of the well-to-do and the working class and poor immigrant community. I live in the south side of Seattle. You go out our front door, Ron's heard me say this, you go out our front door and you are in multi-million dollar homes going down to Lake Washington. And you go out our back door and you are in Rainier Valley, which is one of the poorest zip codes in the, well, actually one of the most ethnically and racially diverse zip codes in the United States as well. So I think that's hugely symbolic to live in that, right on that street. So, you guys ready? Oh, my second part of the question. Do you need to have lost or suffered to choose this path? Who among us has not lost or suffered in some way?
Okay. Someone asks, what about cooperating with other nonprofit organizations? And yes, as the diners and the servers become blurred, there's this line, it is amazing what you can do when no one cares who gets the credit. You all heard that line? That is a missional mindset. So you are more focused on the impact, on the relationship, than on the institution keeping. Paradoxically, it vivifies, energizes the institution. So yes, finding ways. And this means coalition building. There is a woman in Oak Ridge who does a ministry of anti-choice, and so she and I are not going to work together on reproductive rights, right? But we are going to work together on a coat drive in the winter. So even though, and she's not happy with me today about marriage equality on Facebook, but that's okay because I love her. And even she will be saved in the end because I'm going to keep on loving her. And I know that her small God is not the end of her journey. Okay? And I know that doing coat drives with her is an opportunity to be in relationship with her suffering, that small, cramped, hurtful, and hurting God. So some of that coalition building is with unlikely partners, partners who don't fit the pedigree of the liberal versus conservative model.
Yeah, and start nonprofits out of your churches. You know, that's what we did. We started a nonprofit to do a lot of the missional connections and missional work. So there's nothing that keeps you from beginning many nonprofits. Is there a book that could serve as a common read? I would say two. One is by UU and one is not. One is the guy I mentioned earlier was Reggie McNeil. And these are all on your handouts if you have the handout. It's called Missional Renaissance. And the second one is by Michael Dural, a Unitarian Universalist church consultant. His book, The Almost Church Revitalized, carries within it, particularly for institutional churches, a lot of ways to begin making that shift.
We're on time.
10 more minutes.
Right.
So
yeah. I'll answer.
These questions, we will gather them up. Okay. We will put them on our
mic.
Oh, can't do that. We will respond to all these questions. We can do that through the website missionalprogressives.blogspot.com, which is on your handout. So it's one way. We don't feel like you're neglected. We'll actually do this and we'll respond in print.
I'll answer two quick questions and then I'll do my piece. One is more questions about the fundraising and the financial sustainability. It depends a lot on how you're doing it. I can tell you that my experience actually echoes Jake's. This year, our budget is the same approximately as it was when I got there, the pledge income, but we're getting that same amount from half the number of people. So our pledges have basically become, our people have become much more generous because they're inspired, because they know what we're doing is really making a difference in the world. And I think that actually connects in a lot of ways to the next question, because this is, I'd like to see this focus in my congregation. It's difficult to get agreement about how to focus our efforts in a single direction. Don't focus them on a single direction. One of the things that I think has been most powerful for me is the model of having people listen to how they are called to serve the world. How are you called to serve the world? And then the church can train you and give you the resources you need and then send you forth. And so
rather than focusing on one single thing that either you love it or you don't, and then you leave and you go find somewhere else, find how other people's hearts break, and then empower them to fill that need themselves. And I guarantee there are going to be people in the congregation that when they hear that there are these activities taking place are going to join in, and they're going to say, oh, we want to do that. One of the most successful in our program at our congregation is actually the Navigators program. We have a brand new Navigators. It's a co-ed scouting program. There is a booth downstairs in the exhibit hall. I highly recommend it. It has brought in so many people. It was the idea of one or two, and they loved it into being. And now it is spreading. We serve children in the community. It's growing. The more grants we give them, the more they're able to do. And so, the fundraising is tied to how invested people feel, and people feel more invested when they can find ways that their heartbreak can be addressed. Okay. Yeah, I know, but it's over there. I don't want to cut their heads off with this wire. So Emerson says that a person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. We may think our tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and character. Therefore, he says, it behooves us to be careful about what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming. And I think that when he's talking about worshiping, he also is talking about what we serve. A person will serve something, some mission. I think that in many ways, we're all already missional because we're serving some mission already, subconsciously or unconsciously. We are already serving something. What missional does is it makes it explicit. It makes it explicit that we are serving our community. We are serving in our location. We are serving right here. We are not serving our budget. We are not worshiping our membership numbers. We are not serving our potluck group. We are serving the community. And so missional makes it explicit. And it says, why do we exist? So why? What purpose do we have to serve? I have seen in the past that Unitarian Universalists tended to worship membership numbers, right? It's another one of those uncomfortable giggles that Jake was talking about. We were told that we should grow our membership and that the more your church grew, the more successful you were, and that's a very small measure of success. I'm not arguing that the world wouldn't be a better place without more Unitarian Universalists in it. Absolutely. I think the world would be a better place. Maybe. I hear some maybes. It does depend on what they do. But if we want the world to be a better place, then I think that we need to think larger than just growing our faith tradition. We need to be thinking about how many lives we can touch. Not how many lives we bring through our doors, not how many lives join our congregations, but how many lives can we touch? This is why I think the love the hell out of the world theme is so compelling. Because it doesn't depend on conversion. It doesn't depend on people. It starts with me, and it starts with what I can do. Now, we've also been told that if we are doing it right, then they will come. If we're doing it right, if we're doing social justice right, if we're doing our mission right, then the people will show up at our congregations, and then they'll join, and then we can put them on a committee, and then they'll pledge. So we're going to do the right thing, but we're not doing it for the right reason, right? And so that instead, right now, what we're trying to do with missionally is to ask instead, are we living faithfully in relationship to our community? Not with the goal of getting them in our doors so that we can then put them on that path to membership, but instead so that we can touch more lives and we can make a difference in our community. This means shifting our focus. It means shifting our focus from an inward focus to a more outward focus. It means shifting from a program orientation to a people orientation. So that's why what I just said about the not having just one thing. Go find out what your people's heart breaks for and then make that happen. Don't make it a program. Make it about serving the people. And then the third thing about the missional shift means shifting from creating church leaders to creating community leaders. Because what you want to be doing is empowering people to go find out what their heart breaks for and then go make a difference in the world. Because that's what we want to do. We want to make a difference in the world, all of us. So shifting from training people in how to run a meeting and in Robert's rules to how to have a conversation with somebody who is so different than who we are. Missional asks, for whom does your heart break? It saves us from our competence and lets us lead with our authenticity and our vulnerability. So imagine what that would look like. Imagine leading from our heartbreak instead of our strengths. It's kind of scary, isn't it? If it is, you're doing it right. If it's not scary, if it's not bringing you in contact with your places of discomfort, then that's not doing it right. So I want you to imagine imagine your congregation encouraging you to answer that question of, for whom does your heart break? Encouraging you to live your faith beyond just worship and giving you opportunities to be the church in your community. Imagine touching lives well beyond the walls of your congregation. Imagine your district or region as being able to train leaders and provide resources that would allow them to embody our faith in their communities, especially in communities where there may not be any brick or mortar congregation. I'm really excited by many of these emerging congregations or the emerging communities, emerging covenant communities. What is the covenanted communities, because this is exactly what they're all about, getting trained and then going and being the church in the world. Imagine our association being released from our fears of inadequacies, released from our concerns about numerical growth, and instead being better able to speak truth to power, being better able to take risks, and encouraging such behavior in others. Imagine our faith tradition as truly proclaiming that it is our mission to love the hell out of the world. So what does that mean? Loving the hell out of the world means being in relationship with the world, means being in the world. It means being embedded in the world. It means constantly expanding who we are. It means challenging ourselves to not turn away from the pain within ourselves and within others, but instead to walk towards it, to know that that pain brings us together. Loving the hell out of the world means loving each other out of hell, going into hell, taking that third path. It means listening to one another. It means learning from one another. It doesn't mean we're always going to agree, because we're not. We need not think alike to love alike, right? But it means that we stay in conversation because our mission is the same, even if our politics or our theology are different. Loving the hell out of the world means overcoming fear, overcoming bitterness and hatred with abounding and embodied love. No matter how you phrase your theology, if we believe that we are made in the image of God, or if we are the hands of the ultimate, or if you believe that we are part of the mutual garment of destiny, part of the interdependent web of all existence, no matter what your theology, then we are called to live the hell out of the world, to both save it and savor it. And there can be no other way. Thank you.
Somebody's calling my name, oh my Lord, oh my Lord.
and gather back together in B 115, 116, and 30 minutes for part two.